Alan Chartok. Delighted to be in conversation today with Dr. Donald P. Christian, 8th President at the State University of New York in New Paltz. Dr. Christian has an BS in wildlife biology, something I don't want to talk to him about today, and an MS and PhD in zoology from Michigan State University. Before becoming president at New Paltz, Dr. Christian served as provost and vice president for academic affairs at New Paltz from 2009 to 2010. As president, he is responsible for all aspects of campus academic and administrative operations, including education, research, and faculty recruitment and development. Working in collaboration with internal and external constituencies, the president provides overall leadership and guidance for the college. The president also represents the campus interests within the SUNY system with local and state elected officials and surrounding communities and leads or supports many aspects of the college's role in SUNY and New York State economic development initiatives. Prior to his arrival at New Paltz, Dr. Christian was dean at the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire from 2004 to 2009. Before that, Dr. Christian was associate dean for the biological sciences at the University of Montana, 1997 to 2004. Dr. Christian has also held many positions at the University of Minnesota at Duluth, 1978 to 1997, including chair of biology and director of graduate studies in the biology graduate program. Dr. Christian is a member of the boards of directors of Hudson Valley Pattern for Progress and the Mohawk Preserve. His other memberships include the Advisory Council of Historic Huguenot Street, the President's Trust of the Association of American Colleges and Universities, and he's a consultant with Mohawk Consultation. Dr. Christian and his wife Sandy, a psychotherapist, reside in New Paltz and have two adult children. We'll talk with New Paltz President Dr. Donald Christian about all of this, as well as the college's five-year strategic plan. But first, welcome Donald Christian.
Good morning, Alan. It's great to be with you again.
Well, it's great to have you here. You've been a terrific president for New Paltz, and everybody's talking about you. So I'm fascinated between the relationship between your sort of major field of interest, which is zoology, and keeping the faculty in line. So you get it? In other words, if you have to watch the way in which faculty, you know, the only reason politics is so ugly in the university academic politics is that the stakes are so low, but you have that job of keeping everybody happy. And does your zoological training help you do that?
Well, you know, I have presidential colleagues with all kinds of academic backgrounds and some non-academic backgrounds as well, and they all bring different kind of perspectives and strengths and approaches. I think one of the things that a scientist brings to the work of a president, whether it's biology or chemistry, is that we're used to making decisions that are informed by data, used to thinking in terms of process. And that's true whether you're a computer scientist or an engineer or a biologist. So, you know, we can make all kinds of jokes about, as I do sometimes with my students, about how handling wild rodents is great background to be a college president. But it's really more those process and decision-making backgrounds that I think I have drawn most from my background.
Well, now, sometimes you have to do things that are not proven in advance. You have to take a chance and do something that's innovative. For example, New Paltz is being innovative when it comes to 3D printing, an initiative that New Paltz is sort of unique in, and economic impact on your region. What's the thinking there?
It's an exciting initiative. We've had a number of kind of long-term discussions about ways that we can build on our strong traditions in the arts, interface them with technology, engineering, computer science, and 3D printing was one that was sort of bubbling along just below the surface. And as we started thinking about how we could concentrate that interplay between art and technology, 3D printing emerged as a very sharp focus at a time that this is a technology that's gaining lots and lots of traction in advanced manufacturing, prototyping, application to just a whole broad array of industries and businesses, from jewelry making to theater design to architecture to biomedical to food. And so we're very excited about being at the forefront of that initiative.
Well, you know, this is very interesting. So the relationship between New Paltz and art is well known. New Paltz is a terrific school when it comes to
Absolutely.
Art. Then along comes the governor, and he says, why don't we set up these initiatives at these colleges and offer tax advantages to anybody who becomes a partner and plays a role? So the first thing is that New Paltz has always been an extraordinary liberal arts school where, you know, one allegedly learns how to think. That's the program. So my question would be, are we going into an area which is far more pragmatic, far more business-oriented than teaching people how to think?
No.
That's a good answer. You make a very good interview. Thank you.
We're very concerned and very much value the fact that an engineer, for example, educated at an institution like New Paltz is different than an engineer educated at a polytechnic institute. And we value that. We want to keep educating engineers who have that creativity, that broad focus that comes from teaching at a liberal arts institution. And our 3D printing effort really embodies that. So we're not training people to sit at a machine and punch a button to run a 3D printer. We're interested in forging partnerships that take advantage of the creativity that grows out of the arts with the technological focus that's associated with engineering, computer science, in blending those in a novel way.
I'm sorry, Don, what is 3D printing for everybody out there who might not know?
In the simplest form, a 3D printer melts plastic, deposits it in a thin layer, and builds a three-dimensional structure in that fashion. There are other ways to do this. With some 3D printers that print in metal, we'll deposit metal powder and then fuse them together by applying a laser, and again build up a three-dimensional object by gradually fusing additional layers of metal powder on top of those bottom layers. The beauty of this is that I could take your coffee cup, for example, and we could scan that in three dimension and print a new one from that. So it's a different way of doing sculpture, perhaps.
Will it come to our home computers at any point?
Very likely. One of the companies that we're partnering with, MakerBot, is a leading manufacturer of desktop 3D printers, and MakerBot is really interested in seeing 3D printing infused throughout schools. We have a number of faculty and staff at the college who are acquiring 3D printers at home. I've even thought about getting one for
But that costs. I mean, how can you tell a kid who can't just make it? How much, by the way, does a college education for anybody who doesn't get aid cost at New Paltz a year now?
Full costs, room, board, tuition, living on campus, about $18,000 a year.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah. But I would point out that if that student were living at home, they would have some costs as well. So some of that cost includes just the cost of living.
Yeah.
Insurance, food, recreation, all the things that somebody would be spending, even if they weren't a student.
If you had your choice, Don Christian, if you had your choice and you could take every kid in New York State who qualified and give them a free college education as opposed to one that cost $18,000, would you do it?
I'd have to think carefully about that because there's some indication that if people are investing their time, their money, and their education, they recognize a little more what's at stake and put more into it.
That's what the psychiatrists say when they get people sitting there. They say, you know, if you're paying for it, you'll value it more. I went to Hunter College, which I valued very much, and it cost nothing.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of other people who I am sure went to college with me who would not have been there otherwise.
And a lot of our alumni from earlier decades have that same very positive experience when their SUNY education was free. But, you know, we're not asking students to buy 3D printers. So we've secured some private funding, some outside grants. We're continuing to pursue additional funding so that we can build that infrastructure on the campus as institutional property to provide students and faculty and members of the business community with access to that equipment.
Now, Mr. President, you know full well, as I do, right, that there are always unforetold consequences that come out of a movement. So, for example, the one that shows up in the newspapers all the time is people who want to build guns with 3D printers so that they can get through undetected through the airports and other places. And I'm sure there are other things besides that.
Every technology can be put to good use and bad use, and 3D printing is not at all unique in that realm. The curriculum that we've developed and the curricula that we'll continue to develop also talk about responsible use of technology, about the ethical obligations that we have. And so those are certainly concerns, but we're trying to be attuned to them and manage them in the right way.
Now, Don Christian, every SUNY is now being requested or required to come up with a program that sort of piggybacks with the business community so that upstate, which is where SUNYs are, depending on how you define upstate, become the hub of regenerating or building business in upstate New York. How did it come to be that 3D printing became yours?
Well, it's not the only one that we're focusing on, but it's such an innovative technology, the use of which reinforces reinforces some of my values in interdisciplinarity, which is a strong value among many faculty at the institution as well. So the idea that we can get artists and engineers working together on similar problems and building teams of engineering and art students to work on projects, that's the world of work that our students will inherit. So 3D printing is exciting to us in part because it's academically innovative. As we think about becoming a regional hub for economic development, we clearly don't want to lose sight of the fact that we're first and foremost an educational and academic institution. But to the degree that we can build programs that do things like let us partner with businesses that create scholarly or research opportunities for faculty and that provide new internship opportunities for students, and where we might have employees at those businesses being able to come in and teach a course or give a guest lecture in a way that enhances our academic program and that shows promise of hiring well-qualified graduates of our programs, that's a win-win all the way around for the economy and for the institution and our mission as an academic and educational institution in the Hudson Valley.
Don, are you finding businesses, specific businesses, coming to you now saying, I want to be part of this?
We're having a number of early inquiries from 3D printing companies, from digital design and production companies. We've had a variety of contacts like that. But the Startup New York initiative is still very early in its development and planning. We're trying to refine at this moment our campus plan, but it will embody those kind of values that I just laid out.
Now, when each of you, your colleagues, other college presidents and other university presidents get together, is there any horse trading that goes on saying, we're going to do this 3D printing and keep your hands off it?
More likely, we're looking at ways for collaboration. So, you know, I've talked with a presidential colleague at another SUNY campus where there's an architecture program, which we don't have. And 3D printing is increasingly of application in architecture. So there's an opportunity there for collaboration. We're also working very closely with community colleges in the Hudson Valley to develop partnerships there so that students in their first 2 years, say as pre-engineers at one of the community colleges, can learn about 3D printing early on, bring that background into their transfer to New Paltz. So yes, we recognize that we compete with each other, but we're also looking at ways that we can collaborate.
Hey, Don Christian, is there any way that the state university campuses which get into these initiatives can actually make money that will help them with their fiscal issues?
We've not thought about this so much as a money maker for the institution, so much as a way that we can bolster regional economies and create opportunities for building the workforce and the economy in the Hudson Valley. And that's part of the interest that we've been getting from external partners. So we've been working with Hudson Valley Economic Development Corporation, for example, that's interested in building business and industry in the Hudson Valley. Hudson River Ventures has been working with us as well, and they're also interested in building and attracting businesses to the Hudson Valley. So we're thinking more in terms of a rising tide that floats all boats, including that of the college.
Wow. You mentioned the word interns before. There's a big fight coming up on interns, you know, which is, should somebody have an internship if they're not being paid for it? My early time in New Paltz, long preceding you, was to start the Legislative Gazette internship program for New Paltz. And the internship, frankly, the first one in the legislature, modern internship in the legislature. To me, the students are getting huge benefits from having some time there. And I'm afraid that if you were to say to everybody you have to pay them, you would have many less internship opportunities. Because after all, they're not there forever. They're there for a fairly short academic semester, and then they're gone. And I can't tell you how many people here at WAMC have started as interns and are here now in full-time jobs. So I'm wondering what your take on all of this is.
Well, I appreciate some of the concerns there in terms of unpaid interns competing with people who might be given paid employment. The educational value of internships is so well documented, so well demonstrated, that it's critical that we provide these kinds of opportunities for our students. We do surveys of internship providers for New Paltz students, and uniformly, they're so positive about the new energy, the new perspective, the talent that students bring to their organizations. In some cases, these are nonprofits. In some cases, they're businesses and industries that are for profit. Some of our interns end up getting hired by those companies, and it's a great way for a company to have a better way to test the capability of a future employee than sitting down and interviewing them, no matter how careful we are with our interview processes. I've also talked with students over the years, many years, for whom internships do several things. In some cases, they cement and reinforce and kind of crystallize what students have been learning in the classroom, but they never quite knew why they were learning it. I've also talked with students who avoided going down a career path that would have been wrong for them because they had an internship experience. One student I remember from many, many years ago as a biology professor had done an internship in a hospital after his sophomore year, pre-med student, and he realized that he didn't like being around sick people and blood. You know, what a time to come to that realization rather than in medical school. So I appreciate the dynamics there, but these are such valuable experiences for our students. We're continuing to work at all levels to identify opportunities for our students to take part in this process.
Well, to be fair, I think some of the people who have objected to not paying interns are doing so because after the students graduate, they go to work for, quote, internships, and those are unpaid, and they don't generate academic credit, and, you know, and there may be some exploitation there that doesn't exist in, you know, in other places. Yeah. So I'm fascinated by the coordination of all of these efforts on the part of the state university. We have great chancellor, Chancellor Zimpfer, who obviously is cooperating with the governor, and all of you college presidents and university presidents are trying to figure out what your niche will be. Can you give us some insight into what that dynamic looks like?
Well, it's complex, as I'm sure you imagine. I think those of us who deal with institutional budgets and recognize the multiple competing demands on state resources recognize that even though, as I said earlier, we're primarily academic and educational institutions, if we can play a role in boosting the economy of New York, ultimately it will do all of us good by reducing some of the bottlenecks in state funding that has clearly been diminishing for public higher education, restore some of the resources that are available to advance the educational mission that we value so much. So this really requires avoiding all or none thinking that, you know, that we're academic institutions and therefore we can't be involved in economic development. Or if we get involved in economic development, it comes at the cost of academic focus and quality. And I don't believe that. I think we have to try to find those sweet spots where we bring those initiatives together in ways that boost the economy and provide opportunities for students and faculty.
Well, and I have to say that from my perspective, if I'm a student, that's exactly what I want, because anything that leads to the potential for career development is, you know, you say to a class of students, what's your number one priority? And they're going to tell you getting a job. They may respect getting, you know, an infusion of liberal arts thinking, but that isn't what they or their parents are thinking at any given moment.
Well, and again, I think that's a complex conversation to have, and it's one where we have to avoid all or none thinking, because many studies show, for example, that classic liberal arts graduates may not compete with business or accounting or nursing majors for that first job. Over time, they catch up, and there's some staying power in what people learn as liberal arts graduates. By the same token, we know that there are lots of jobs that demand capability and versatility with technology. And so in some ways, I think about 3D printing as perhaps a technological liberal arts. You know, we're not trying to train students for particular jobs in a particular industry or a particular business, but fueling that creativity in a technological world. And that's a way, I think, to think about 3D printing and what it means academically for us.
Now, your 3D printing project, Don Christian, is being part of the MakerBot Innovation Center. Tell us about MakerBot.
MakerBot and its CEO, Bree Pettis, who was, and you're, I think, aware that in the last couple of weeks, we had a ribbon-cutting ceremony on the campus installation of the first MakerBot Innovation Lab in the country. And institutions that have done this have had the experience where you're teaching a class of 30 students or 24 students, and you have two 3D printers. And so you're limited in what you can do.
Sure.
So having access
or two computers.
Yeah. So having access to a bank of 30 MakerBot 3D printers changes the dynamic of what we can do, and it democratizes this a bit. So that's part of our goal.
Does that take retraining? I'm sorry, Don. Does that take retraining on the part of the faculty who are now going to teach these engineering classes, for example?
Some, although more and more mechanical engineering is pretty tightly linked to 3D printing. So that's one of the reasons that we've been moving ahead with the proposal to expand our engineering to include mechanical engineering. Those two disciplines are pretty tightly tied at the hip, as well as some of the arts programs. There are clearly needs for faculty development to do this. Our Dean of Science and Engineering and our Advanced Manufacturing Center at New Paltz are introducing some training for faculty and staff to use our 3D printers, not necessarily to get them positioned to the point where they can teach a course, but so that they become more familiar with the technology, more familiar with its capabilities.
So how do you make a tenured professor willing to learn something new? You know, there are those people who have natural inquisitive minds who want to know.
Sure.
There are other people who, well, I don't know much about New Paltz these days. I remember in the old days, there were a few who would retire and stay. How do you get that person to re-up?
Well, maintaining career vitality of faculty over a 35 or 40-year career is something that institutions pay a lot of attention to. We're increasingly developing new programs for faculty development, recognizing that if faculty are going to move in new directions, we may need to provide support. It may be a course release. It may be financial support for a summer training program. Part of our 3D printing initiative will include summer institutes focused mostly on high school teachers and community college teachers in the Hudson Valley, again, to help with that infusion of the technology at different educational levels. And certainly our faculty will have opportunity to take part in those initiatives as well.
How come New Paltz continues to be one of the most, if not the most, selective colleges in the state university system? I'm very proud of that, by the way. I mean,
we are too.
Yeah.
We are too. Part of it is we're in a great geographical area, you know, in a tremendous area in which to live and work and study, close proximity to a major metropolitan area. But we also hear from students and from prospective students about attributes like the diversity of the campus, the sort of questing nature that we...
Diversity meaning all kinds of people, different skin colors, different nationalities, that kind of thing.
Religions, political views, and our participation in student surveys shows that our students are much more likely than their peers at other institutions to have, for example, meaningful conversations with fellow students from different racial or ethnic backgrounds, meaningful conversations with people of different political beliefs. And so that we hear about the great diversity of academic programs at New Paltz that attract students. Probably a third of our students come into New Paltz as first-year students not knowing what they want to major in. And having that array of opportunities in encouraging that exploration is also very appealing to a lot of students.
I have young people in this office here all the time saying, where should I go? And showing me choices. I've always said New Paltz. A, because I'm so proud of spending all those years at it. But also because there is something, I don't know, it's almost intangible about the place that makes it, you know, like Lake Wobegon, a place that people don't ever forget. It has a soul.
It has a soul. I've described that in the language that I just used as sort of a questing or inquisitive culture, very accepting of differences. As you know, having been a faculty member there, and this is a long-standing part of the DNA of the institution, an openness, if not an encouragement, to challenge each other, to challenge authority, to question why we do things certain ways. And that's obviously challenging for a college president, but it's also part of the vitality of the institution.
So when you make rules for your campus, you know, rules, thou shalt not, that's a balance too, right? You don't want to go too far, but on the other hand, you don't want chaos.
Correct. So we have to be sure we stay true to our mission. And some rules help us stay focused on our mission. We spend a lot of money. You know, I'm responsible for a $65 million core instructional budget, for example, and we have to be sure we're using that resource as well as the facilities, state facilities that we live and work in the most responsible way that we can. And so some of our rules are to protect the mission and the integrity of what we're doing as a public institution.
For example?
Oh, procurement policies is one, and they're onerous sometimes, but there are good reasons why we have some of our procurement rules. We have travel regulations in requests for reimbursement that some of these are financial accountability matters.
Sure. What are your nightmares, Mr. President? In other words, what is it that one worries about? Is it that a kid, you know, we see this at NYU and other places, a kid commits suicide? Is this one of the great nightmares that a president has?
It's a nightmare for a college president to ponder the death of a student or an employee on campus. And it happens. We had a death in the last several weeks on campus. It's sobering for a college campus, in part because for many of our 18 and 19-year-old students, it's their first experience with mortality. And so we try to manage those happenings with sensitivity, with respect for families, with balancing the need for a community to know that something has happened on the campus with the questions about what do people need to know about the circumstances. And so we try to manage those carefully. Those are extremely trying when they happen. When they do happen and the response and the communication is managed well, it really reinforces the importance of planning. So those are certainly nightmarish circumstances.
So to some degree, you are the head in loco parenti. In other words, you're there watching people's kids for them, and they expect certain things from you, and you have to do them.
Yeah, as much as in loco parentis has fallen out of vogue, when circumstances like that occur, there's an expectation that you're stepping back into that role as an institution.
Why has it fallen out of vogue?
Well, I think that students coming to college as 18-year-olds are more grown up than maybe was the case when you and I were students. There was an expectation to a much greater degree among parents that my kid's going off to your campus. Some of this is changes in technology that make communication much more immediate and continuous now than it was. You know, when I was an undergraduate student, I would call home once a month or once every 2 months. And
reverse the charges.
Sometimes, yes. And now, you know, there's multiple contacts by Facebook and cell among our students and our parents. So that may be one of the biggest things that's changed that since.
So just last night I was watching the TV a little bit and came across Mutiny on the Bounty, and I'm sure you can see where this is coming from. And there was a Mr. Christian there, too. And I'm wondering about, inevitably, some faculty member with too much time on their hands decides they're going to start up. Maybe it's because they're challenged. Maybe because you're saying to them, hey, you know, reorient yourself. Start thinking about 3D printing and start thinking about the way in which the liberal arts all interact with each other. And some guy who says, I don't want to do that. And so I'm going to get on Christian's case. Ever had a mutiny?
Never had a mutiny. Knock on wood. You asked about nightmares, and certainly there are the terrible nightmares of a student death on campus, some that are a little less nightmarish, but keep presidents awake, is how to manage the alignment of internal expectations with external realities. And so this is something that we communicate about continuously to try to build that alignment so that people are understanding as much as possible the kinds of external constraints and opportunities and challenges that we face and what that has to do with how we run our programs internally. And so I think we're continually trying to communicate those issues, those opportunities, trying to keep people focused on, and I often come back to this question, that if we can reframe some of our arguments about what's best for students, it changes a lot of that dynamic.
We're talking to Donald Christian, who is the president of SUNY at New Paltz, a place I consider my home, for whatever it's worth. Let me go forward and ask you about this business of faculty. Do you interview every faculty member who gets hired at the place? You sit in a building called the Hagerty Administration Building, and I remember old man Hagerty interviewing every single person who walked into that place. And as a result, having universal enmity from a certain group of people who process through, many of whom are gone now. But how do you control who gets hired?
I really have to delegate that individual responsibility to the deans and the provost. My provost interviews candidates for positions, vets candidates before they're invited to campus for interviews. the provost and I pay a lot of attention to the principles that we try to reinforce in hiring new faculty. But it's really beyond my bandwidth to be able to interview.
But if things blow up, Don, it's going to land on your desk no matter who you delegate to. Certainly that's true here at WAMC. There's
sure.
a problem. It's going to land on my desk
sure.
sooner or later. So, you know, I'm thinking about a department when I was long ago when I was there that had a particular political orientation. And, you know, that bled over into their hiring and retention tenuring process. That's the kind of thing that I guess I was asking about. It's a
yes.
long time ago.
Yeah. And balancing that departmental autonomy with institutional goals and values is an ongoing challenge. Part of all of this is really guided and framed by careful planning, including a strategic plan that we might talk about that's laid out priority directions for us.
Okay, let's talk about it.
We undertook this process 2 years ago as a community process. Rather than the president saying, this is what we're going to do for the next 5 years, we wanted to put in place a process that the community would guide what our biggest priorities should be to become a better institution 5 years from now than we are at the start of that process.
Okay, I need a definition of community. I'm sorry for doing that to you because I know how often that's done. But what do you mean? Do you mean the people at the college of the community or the people around the college?
People at the college, students, faculty, staff, alumni, foundation board directors. And those were the people primarily involved with our planning process. So we undertook a variety of interviews with probably 120 members of the college community. We had a strategic planning retreat day-long in November of 2012, and there were probably 70 people that took part in that. Subsequent conversations as the strategic planning steering committee was developing priorities to get community feedback and reaction to our priorities. And that's really set a course for us for what we're going to focus on most during the next 5 years. And it provides a framework for how we allocate resources, including financial resources, but also faculty and staff time. We've tried to do that in a way that it's based on a careful assessment of the external environment, builds on things that New Paltz does well and how we can do them even better. Again, focus very clearly on students and student success.
The governor just did something I consider to be quite courageous. He announced that in order to limit recidivism at the state's prisons, he was going to try to pay some money to each inmate who wanted or could go to college. And, you know, I thought it was very brave. I think the reaction has been predictable. Do you still teach?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I give guest lectures in classes now and then.
That's great.
Yeah.
I walked into my Legislative Gazette seminar the other day, and I asked them, how many of you think that the state should give $5,000 to each felon in order to move forward and prevent recidivism? And the class was almost united in, hell no, we have to pay for it. Why should they get it? Does that surprise you?
The reaction that I've heard, including that one, doesn't surprise me. It's disappointing, I think. I understand the basis for it. Clearly, it's paying attention to individual circumstances and not the broader issues of the tremendous amount of resources that we invest in our criminal justice system and the cost to society of housing prisoners and returning them to prison in our penal system on a pretty regular basis.
So when you see a governor step into this hotbed of, you know, resistance, which predictably the Republican legislators have been, many of them have been opposed to this thing, a few Democrats. What about your leadership role? You've just made your point. I mean, you've been supportive. But is that something you have to worry about as a college president? You've got Republican senators in your district. You've got Democratic assemblymen. How do you handle that?
Well, first of all, I try to keep a focus on what matters to our institution, as well as to higher ed overall. I try to work with our individual legislators, and our Hudson Valley state legislators have been very supportive of higher ed, very supportive of SUNY New Paltz. I'm also very careful about the public stances that I take on issues that might bear on the college's future one way or another, because I recognize that I can never take off the hat of college president. So anything I say, I'm saying as college president and speaking largely on behalf of the institution. So I'm naturally reticent and a little bit conservative about speaking on controversial proposals in our state government.
Are there things that you intuitively know to stay away from? One of your predecessors years ago, you know, on his watch, there was a very famous sex conference put on, and they actually had the vagina monologues for the first time, I think, in a college setting or very close to it, and he had a governor come after him at the time. Is there a light bulb up there somewhere in your mind when you hear something like this that says, hell no, I don't want to do this?
I think there are important things that are done at colleges and universities that presidents don't necessarily need to own. So academic conferences, for example, or guest speakers that are brought to institutions.
Always danger areas.
Well, they are danger areas, but I remember once many years ago, the president at the University of Montana was challenged with a class that wanted to bring in one of the white supremacist leaders.
Sure.
And it was in a class on hate speech, I think. And he was going to be criticized no matter what. But he managed that in a way, insisting that the academic freedom rights of the institution mattered, but also that there had to be an academic box put around this so that this was an academic presentation and not an opportunity for this person to espouse his political views. That's always been a really good model for me, inspiring me to think about how institutions can do things, but how we do them for the right reasons and protect the institutional integrity in the process.
Well, Don Christian, you know, when I was at Hunter all those years ago, 59 to 63, I do remember the socialist Norman Thomas being invited to come in and give a speech. Now, right now in New York City, you can't go a block without finding a Norman Thomas school or something that's been named after him. But then there was hell to pay. And obviously, universities are places that become the vanguard for future thinking.
Indeed, and we should be. And I think the political discourse in our country has taken the unfortunate turn that sometimes by simply listening to an opposing viewpoint, mm-hmm. people regard you as having endorsed that viewpoint. And this is a difficult ground for colleges and universities because we value academic freedom, we value free speech, and it's part of our responsibility to encourage those kinds of dialogues, doing so in a way that we recognize that we're not endorsing the views that are being expressed.
How much capital do you have? I mean, all presidents have a bank account of, you know, what they can afford to do and what they can't afford to do, whether, you know, before they get out on a ledge. You know, one college president once said to me, I gave you a tenure because we all get a few of those that we're allowed to do, even though some of my colleagues had objections to it. And another came to one of your predecessors and said, we want him fired when running the Legislative Gazette. And I said, well, why? And he said, because of what he writes. And he said, I can't. He's got tenure, you know. There was that. I'm wondering how much you had. Do you ever say, I've got this in the bank and I can afford to use it, or maybe I should never use it?
I tend not to think in those kinds of terms so much as being able to explain why I've made a decision. And throughout my administrative career, I've gotten feedback from people that they haven't necessarily agreed with the decision that I've made.
Sure.
But they've understood why I made it and were glad that I took the time to explain the basis for the decision. And I think that helps cover a lot of that ground.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever been threatened?
No.
Personally? Interesting.
No.
So you're a successful man. I get threatened. So is there a New York state of mind that is different from a Minnesota state of mind? You were at both places. Is there a worldview that exists in some places that surprise you when you get there?
Just like the last time we talked, you really are trying to get me in trouble, aren't you?
Well, that's always my job, yeah, sure.
Yeah. It's amazed me moving from Minnesota to Montana to Wisconsin to New York that there are elements of the culture that play out at the institution. So we talk about Minnesota nice. And I'm sure you've heard that term, which is you're never quite sure where you stand because people are a little reluctant to particularly be critical. And so you learn where you've disappointed somebody, often through a roundabout way. And I was quite struck when I moved to Montana that people were much more direct, much more upfront. And that was a shift from being in Minnesota in a very positive way.
So now let's go to Wisconsin. where, you know, I wrote a book about the Wisconsin legislature. I spent a lot of time up there. And we had Joe McCarthy on the right, and we had a number of people on the left. So that's real dangerous stuff, isn't it?
Actually, during the time that I was there, I was impressed with the embodiment that I saw of the Wisconsin ideal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea that public universities exist to serve their state and their region.
So people like La Follette.
Yeah. Great forward-looking social and political environment that's changed in the 4 or 5 years since I've left fairly dramatically, I hear from my colleagues. So, you know, I had that sense of the Wisconsin tradition of social progressiveness, political progressiveness. Coming to New York, I've also been pleased at how upfront and direct people are in expressing viewpoints, not necessarily in the same way that it was done in Montana, but you typically end up having a pretty good sense of where you stand with people. The diversity of New York plays out in very positive ways that I see in my interactions here.
Is DuPaul's upstate?
Sort of not. We talk a lot about the Hudson Valley and the special dynamics of the Hudson Valley because it's rural, but it's so close to New York City that I think it's not upstate like Potsdam or Plattsburgh or Fredonia.
People commute from DuPaul to New York City.
Yeah. And I think also some people in the Hudson Valley bring expectations of a metropolitan environment to that rural setting.
Where are most of the kids who come to New Paltz, students who come to New Paltz, where are they from?
Hudson Valley, Long Island, the five boroughs, and then a scattering from other parts of New York, a few from other states, New Jersey, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, and a pretty good representation of international students as well from huge numbers of countries.
How important is that?
Tremendously important.
Why?
Influences the sense of globalism on the campus, gives New York students lots of opportunity to interact with students from other countries, other cultures, other backgrounds, creates for us a worldwide group of alumni who know New York, who know New Paltz in ways that wouldn't happen if they weren't here. So it's important in many, many ways.
What do you want to get done with the time you have left at New Paltz, which I hope is a long time?
Well, even though I mentioned the strategic plan priorities not being driven top down, they bubbled up from below, they really reinforced many of the visions for New Paltz that I laid out in my inaugural address and even in my application for the presidency. Continuing to grow the academic quality of the institution, continuing a focus on students and the student experience. I'd like to see us become less siloized. Is siloized a word?
No, it is now.
Siloed, maybe siloed is the right verb.
Meaning?
Well, thinking about educating students as whole people. So you know, sometimes we think about academic or curricular and extracurricular learning or co-curricular learning. It really all comes together. We're trying to build that kind of environment at New Paltz as well.
I'm getting along with the private sector. In the old days, I was acutely aware of some of the rivalries between the public and private sector. I once had a conversation with the president of Bard. It was a real eye-opener for me in terms of his competitiveness with the state university. And that was a long time ago, but I'm wondering whether, I never forgot it, but I've been wondering whether you sense that the two sectors are doing better together than they might have in the old days, and how do you know what was in the old days?
Yeah, I can't really comment on what things were like in the old days. I know that we have some collaborations with Marist College, our 3D printing initiative. When we can secure the right kind of funding, there's some potential for letting that technology become available via the cloud. And Marist has a state-supported cloud computing capability that we want to partner to combine our strengths in 3D printing with Marist's cloud computing capability. I have a meeting coming up in the next several weeks with folks at the CIA to talk about...
Being the place where they teach you how to cook as opposed to the place where they
correct.
Do other things.
Yeah. There's some interesting applications of 3D printing in food. that we want.
Really?
Yes.
For example, you want to make a leg of lamb, you just print one?
Well, it's some of it's a little more artistic, you know, it's sort of appealing to the artistry of food, but this is, you know, this is an area that is just now kind of developing, and we're having actually some conversations with local candy makers. I mean, some of this is, you know, think about what you could do with 3D printing in chocolate. So
wait, I don't get that. You mean chocolate becomes an ingredient, the printer prints in chocolate?
Sure, rather than feeding plastic through the 3D printer, you feed chocolate and you can print bonbons or whatever you would like to print. So we're looking at some opportunities there, and given the growing focus on local foods in the Hudson Valley, linked to rejuvenation of Hudson Valley agriculture, there's some pretty cool potentials there as well.
So the long and the short of it is that you seem to be getting along. In the old days, there was a limited amount of state money. Every time the state university got a little money, the privates demanded some money, and there was a war. But I think the privates lost that war. I'm not quite sure how that all worked out.
If there's a war, I'm not involved in it. So that has not been my experience in the Hudson Valley.
So when the best and the brightest kids apply to New Paltz, which is so selective in terms of who it gets, this is a stupid question, I know, but is that good?
How do you mean?
Well, I don't know how I mean it. And in other words, Catholic small c, you know, there is a universality of people who get together. You say, well, the students at New Paltz learn from the foreign students. But, you know, some of the brightest people I have ever met never went to college. And they learn, you know, the University of Hard Knocks, as they say. And when I went to mainly public schools when I was growing up, and I think it did me a world of good when it came to getting along with people who my private school friends never knew. So, you know, there's a span here of how bright people are.
Sure. We want bright, committed, capable students coming to New Paltz, and that's who we get coming to New Paltz, but they come from all kinds of backgrounds. And some from lower socioeconomic classes. This past fall, about 30% of our students were from racial minority groups. So we need to be careful that we recognize that we can be a very diverse campus of bright, committed, engaged students. I maintain that one of the most important features in the quality of a learning environment is the caliber and the dedication of one's classmates, because bright, motivated students push each other up. They motivate each other. I hear all the time our students learning from each other in pretty compelling ways.
You know, I don't know how to put this, but not that long ago, there was a political situation which I found to be, you know, difficult for my Legislative Gazette project, which is a New Paltz project. And I went to somebody who had been in my class, but who is now a high public official. Do we find that as you graduate more and more people and they assume their rightful places and he was very helpful, by the way, and they assume these roles in life, that it helps the university? Do you find that individually?
I'm not sure.
Well, as alumni giving you money or as public officials who say, yeah, I went to New Paltz and I'd do anything for New Paltz, which in this case, this guy didn't.
One of the goals of our strategic plan is to engage our alumni more effectively than we have. And that's for many of the reasons that you lay out. We have, in fact, I had a lunch last week with an alum who works in the financial industry on Wall Street, who was on campus to interview six of our students to select one who he might put forward for an internship program at his company. We obviously, like many other universities, rely on private financial support from alumni. We want to continue building that base. Our alumni engage in advising our programs. What does the world of work need that might require a tweak or a turn here and there in an academic program? So definitely we want to increase that connection to alumni for all those reasons.
And yet, is it your impression that alumni that from independent or private institutions are more likely to have been trained in philanthropy than at a state university?
No question, and that's part of our task is in building a culture of philanthropy is helping our students, while they're students, develop a sense of how they're benefiting from the generosity of others and how they will have an opportunity to support the future by being philanthropic in their own lives.
Well, Don Christian, I always love having a chance to talk to you. You're a very thoughtful man, and I can't fault you on anything that you've said today, so I appreciate it. We've been speaking with Donald Christian, president of the State University of New York at New Paltz. Don, thank you so much for joining us. I'm Alan Chartok.
Thank you, Alan. I appreciate our conversation.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org. Thank you.